This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, May 14, 2003. From WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. US officials insist there's no humanitarian crisis in Iraq, and they give soldiers permission to shoot looters on sight. The US also steps up its diplomatic assault on Cuba. We look at the accusations of spying made by the State Department. And yesterday, another mass deportation took place in New York. We'll hear from the partner of a deported Palestinian man. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The congressional ban on assault weapons will likely expire in 2004, since the House of Representatives refuses to take up the issue, while President Bush does nothing about it. From D.C., James Cullum reports.
As part of his 2000 election campaign, Bush supported the assault weapons ban and received harsh criticism from both the NRA and powerful GOP officials. Without having to completely oppose the NRA, the president can say that he is for the ban, while Congress simply allows it to expire. Eric Howard, Associate Director for Communications with the Brady Campaign, is appalled that House Majority Leader Tom DeLay is backing the expiration of the ban, despite its consequences.
Tom DeLay is going to be allowing criminals to arm themselves with AK-47s and Uzis, and President Bush is having DeLay carry the water for him.
When asked if the president would try to persuade Congress to continue the ban in any other way than by stating his position, White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer said that no future events are planned. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm James Cullum.
The United States government has fulfilled its $700 million promise to Jordan for their help in decimating one of their major trade partners, Iraq. Ula Al-Farawati reports from Amman.
Jordan and the U.S. on Tuesday signed documents for the transfer of $700 million in emergency economic assistance to the kingdom this year to counter the negative impact of the Iraq war on the economy. The emergency assistance to be disbursed during the current fiscal year adds to the $250 million in bilateral economic aid already appropriated for Jordan in 2003, bringing U.S. economic assistance to the kingdom to a record $950 million this year. Jordan is a historical ally for Washington in the Middle East. Unofficial reports claim Jordan supplied the U.S. with vital logistic assistance during the U.S.-led war on Iraq. In Amman, Jordan, this is Ola Farawati for Free Speech Radio News.
The Turkish military has been asked to leave northern Iraq by the Kurds, who say they can manage without them. Ezgi Sirtas has more from Ankara.
The army originally settled in northern Iraq in 1996 in cooperation with Britain and the U.S. to stop conflicts between the Kurdish Democratic Party and the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan. Turkish officials declared they're disturbed by this decision as Turkey wants to keep its dominance over northern Iraq, they say to prevent the formation of any kind of independent Kurdish state. Tomorrow, a group of Turkish diplomats will leave for northern Iraq to talk to Kurds and Turkmens there. The Turkish Kurds have been demanding some political and social rights and freedoms for many years. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ezgi Sertaş from Ankara, Turkey.
This afternoon, the New York City Council is expected to pass the nation's first legislation that would give nannies and other domestic workers better job protections. Ama Bouadi reports from WBAI.
Under the law, hiring families will have to state in writing that they understand the rules concerning basic obligations towards the employed nanny, including wages, hours and social security. Those who fail to adhere to this law will be fined as much as $1,000 and may be imprisoned for up to 1 year. Council member Gail Brewer, who has been a leading advocate, told FSRN why she and other political figures believed that this needed to become law.
Well, it's an important step toward improving the working conditions and basic rights for people who work very hard in our homes and who take care of our most valuable asset, our children.
The passing of this bill has been welcomed with caution by some, as it only applies to nannies who are employed through one of the 70 registered agencies in the city and not through word of mouth. For FSRN in New York City, I am Ama Bouadi.
This week, the International Labour Organization said workplace discrimination is still a global problem, with newer and more subtle forms emerging. Heather Risby has more from the UN.
The ILO study does not give an estimate of the number of people who suffer job discrimination worldwide, but The organization's Secretary General, Juan Somavia, says it is a daily reality for hundreds of millions of people. The report points out that in most countries, including the United States and Western Europe, women are the largest group among those discriminated at workplaces. The ILO researchers warn that failure to confront discrimination and the widening socioeconomic inequalities in the world's labor markets will have disastrous effects on nations' cohesion, political stability, and economic growth. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Rizvi at the United Nations.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
U.S. officials insist there's no humanitarian crisis in Iraq. Independent aid groups, however, beg to differ, citing a UN report that warns more than 300,000 Iraqi children are facing malnutrition. This as the U.S. has given its soldiers on the ground permission to shoot Iraqi looters on sight. Meanwhile, in Washington, Congress debates a $400 billion defense budget. Josh Chaffin reports from D.C.
Retired general and defense contractor Jay Garner tells Congress the humanitarian situation in Iraq can't be called a crisis. This as the UN warns 300,000 Iraqi children are facing death from malnutrition. That's twice as many as before the invasion. Garner's been replaced as the U.S. Viceroy of Iraq by a Henry Kissinger protege and Reagan-era anti-terrorism ambassador named Jerry Bremer. Jim Jennings visits Iraq frequently with the humanitarian group Conscience International.
I think General Garner did one thing right. He admitted that the next 30 to 45 days are critical. They've got too much to do. They don't have what it takes to, in terms of knowledge of the country and the cooperation from the people there to make it work.
Aid groups say the U.S. should immediately ask for greater U.N. and independent humanitarian assistance.
Plus, we have a huge problem with unexploded ordnance. 9 Iraqi children were killed today and 7 injured in a single unexploded ordnance accident in Basra, and that's happening all over the country.
The U.S. is calling on the U.N. Security Council to lift the oil-for-food sanctions against Iraq, but Russia and France worry such a move would end the oil contracts they signed with the former regime. The U.S. wants to leave the contract negotiations up to the Iraqi government, which the U.S. now controls. Mass graves containing tens of thousands of people are being dug up near Baghdad, victims of the former regime's campaign against Shiite Muslims and political enemies. Carol Bogert at Human Rights Watch warns important forensic evidence is being destroyed, criticizing the U.S. for allowing untrained local people to excavate.
This is a matter of absolutely burning and central concern to Iraqis all across that country, and how the U.S. handles it will be an important factor in how their occupation is judged.
A Human Rights Watch spokesman in Baghdad tells reporters that the effort to return government ministries to a functional level has been hampered by widespread looting. U.S. forces now have word they're permitted to shoot looters on site. In Washington, a U.N. resolution on Iraq reconstruction was discussed behind closed doors in the Senate International Relations Committee today. Meanwhile, Congress is working on what could be a $400.5 billion defense budget. Both houses look ready to support development of so-called low-yield nuclear weapons and the resumption of nuclear testing. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld has yet to respond to stories he served on the board of a Swiss company that 3 years ago sold nuclear reactors to North Korea, equipment that can be used to produce nuclear weapons. Today in the Senate Appropriations Committee, Rumsfeld presented a defense budget that would eliminate about 100 reporting requirements, limiting congressional oversight over major weapons programs.
We've proposed more flexible rules for the flow of money through the department to give us the ability to respond to urgent needs as they emerge. We've proposed measures for transforming our system of personnel management so that we can gain more flexibility and agility as to how we manage the more than 700,000 civilians who provide the department such vital support.
They want to gut the civil service system as it is today.
Diane Whittiak with the American Federation of Government Employees.
They also want to strip employees of their collective bargaining rights.
The American Federation of Government Employees warns the Department of Defense proposal opens up the possibility that other government workers' civil service protections are also threatened. Josh Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Washington, D.C.
The State Department yesterday expelled 14 Cuban diplomats from the U.S. They said the 14 were engaged in espionage. Joining me now is Wayne Smith, Senior Fellow at the Center for International Policy and former Chief of the U.S. Interest Section in Havana. Wayne Smith, how do we understand the 14 expulsions of Cuban diplomats by the State Department yesterday?
Well, I think this is an effort on the part of the State Department to look tough. And they don't have all that many options. I mean, we have a full embargo in place against Cuba. We don't have diplomatic relations. We have travel controls in place. So there aren't a lot of things that we can do. But the State Department, because of the crackdown in Cuba, wants to take a tough position. Now, there had been speculation that they might cut off charter flights. But they probably aren't going to do that because the Cuban Americans down in Miami insist on having charter flights so that they can fly to Cuba. So that's an option that probably won't be exercised. In other words, they really are left with very little to do. And so this mass expulsion of Cuban diplomats is supposed to look tough. In fact, it just looks foolish.
Now, many would argue that this mass expulsion based on grounds of the U.S. saying, for example, there is a crackdown on democracy or civil liberties in Cuba is just an excuse. Many would turn around and point the finger at the United States government themselves and say, well, you can't really talk. And many would also say that charges of spying that they've done are committed in minor forms by most diplomats in most countries. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I mean, they're talking about Cuban intelligence activities here. Well, we, of course, have intelligence activities in Cuba. Most countries do have intelligence activities in most other countries. That's part of the norm. It's part of the diplomatic game.
How does this affect the international situation, especially in regards to the United Nations, the fact that the United States has also expelled diplomats who are UN-based?
Well, they have the right to do that under the mission agreement. I think more, how should I put it, worrisome for the United States is the consequences, would be the consequences of this if the Cubans, as we would expect, retaliate by expelling 14 American diplomats from the interest section in Havana. I wonder how they will then issue those 20,000 visas that we are committed to issue, and if we do not issue the visas, that increases the pressures for a maritime exodus. In other words, if Cubans conclude they're not going to be able to come to the United States with visas, they may take to the boats.
Wayne Smith, thank you very much for joining us on Free Speech Radio News. Yesterday, further mass deportations took place from New York and New Jersey. Some 90 Egyptian and Palestinian men were deported to undisclosed locations. WBAI's Ian Forrest has more.
Concerned family members and community activists have spent most of today trying to find information about a group that was deported yesterday. Among them was a Palestinian man, Nabil Ayesh, an asylum seeker and a self-employed individual who has been here in the States for 12 years. His longtime partner, Gina Michael, herself a Muslim American, questions the actions of the authorities in the name of protecting Americans. When she visited him yesterday, it was only after waiting for a while she was told that he had already been put on a plane and sent away. First stop Jordan, thereafter she wasn't told.
They came to tell me that they deported him already and that he was gone, that they sent him in the morning on a plane to go back. And I asked them, why would you let me come here knowing that he's not here? And all that the person said is, you know, like that he should have called. And I say, well, do you allow him a phone call? And they say, no. I say, but you should have told me that, you know, he was gone. They said, oh, you know, it's not our problem. We're sorry, but he's not here.
Ayesh failed in his bid to get asylum and remained in the United States since then because, as a Palestinian, Michael says, there was nowhere to send him. Ms. Michael said, since being here, Ayesh's only crime may have been pasting a sticker on his car written in Arabic.
They arrested him as a terror suspect in Philadelphia, and they transferred him to Brooklyn, New York, and placed him in jail for 1 year and 16 days. 6 months of that he spent in a solitary confinement. He never saw a judge, he never made a phone call, never spoke to a lawyer, and in the end he was never charged with anything. In fact, they just released him back into the streets.
Adam Carroll, coordinator of the 9/11 Relief Program at Islamic Circles of North America, is familiar with Mr. Ayesh's case and has concerns that with his deportation, the U.S. may be subjecting him to danger.
We know that they've been sent, deported from detention here in the United States to Jordan, and they've been tortured there. There are serious concerns about the treatment of detainees, not only in Guantanamo, of course, but in Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. The human rights standards of our country are falling down.
Niaz Kazravi, a spokesperson for Amnesty International, which has been monitoring the situation across the United States over the past year, is similarly concerned.
One of our greatest concerns is that a lot of these people are being sent back to places where they may face persecution. They may be in danger. And there's not much information being given about who's being deported and where they are being deported to.
Meanwhile, in Dearborn, some 50 Arab immigrants are being detained following the discovery of an alleged scam at the Bureau of Citizenship and Immigration Services, formerly the INS, in late April, where a BCI official took money from immigrants to expedite their paperwork. The Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, along with some family members of the detainees, have filed suit against the federal government in order to prevent the deportation of remaining immigrants until after a hearing. A district court judge ruled last week to renew a temporary restraining order preventing the deportation of the would-be immigrants until after another hearing to be held Friday. For Gina Michael, the future in many respects is uncertain, as she waits to be told soon exactly where they have deported her partner, Nabil Ayesh. Reporting for FSRN, I am Ian Forrest.
On Monday, North Korea completely withdrew from the 1992 pact meant to keep the peninsula free of nuclear weapons. North Korea declared a decade-old agreement with South Korea, quote, a dead document, and blamed the United States for the demise of the accord. Meanwhile, a mass strike of truck drivers in South Korea has stopped freight flows worth around $200 million in exports. The strikers are demanding increased rates and tax cuts, while the South Korean president is in the U.S. attempting to attract foreign investors. Simba Russo has this report.
South Korean President Roh Moo-hyun arrived in the United States on Monday for a five-day visit, which included a key summit meeting with President Bush on Wednesday. In contrast, Roh gained popularity among South Koreans as widespread anti-American sentiment began to arise after the acquittal of two soldiers accused of running over two South Korean teens last year with their vehicles. Now a year later, the incident is still a hot topic amongst many Koreans. Yul Song of Nodokdo, speaking at a rally for the two teens.
Military armored vehicle on a road in South Korea. We cannot forget the cries and anguish of the victim's family and friends. Americans need to know what the death of these two students really mean. Those tragic deaths signified many violent crimes committed by U.S. troops stationed in South Korea. It is a call for human conscience. Americans need to know that the past 57 years of suffering and anguish by the Korean people exploded as a result of this incident.
Speaking at the Korea Society dinner where he was being honored, Mr. Roh emphasized the importance of a strong U.S.-South Korean alliance.
As an American ally, Korea has played its role faithfully to the best of its abilities. It actively participated in peacekeeping efforts during the Gulf War and in East Timor. The Korean people shared the sorrow with the American people when 9/11 struck, and Koreans earnestly took part in the U.S.-led campaign to eradicate international terrorism, and we also supported the anti-terrorism war in Afghanistan. For the past 50 years, the Korea-U.S. alliance has contributed greatly to maintaining peace in Korea and peace on the Korean Peninsula, and the role of the U.S. forces in Korea is important to the peace and security of all of Northeast Asia.
During the 1990s, South Korea's economy fell into an $80 billion debt due to stringent IMF policies, causing many South Korean-owned businesses to lose ownership to American companies. Mr. No, former labor activist, reassured business leaders that Korea's labor force and management has made improvements since the crisis. In a speech, No vowed to reform labor and guarantee basic rights and benefits while maintaining that the Korean market will remain wide open to foreign investors. Myung-jung Kim, president of Labor News Production, explained some of the issues concerning labor in South Korea.
In terms of the labor, there are several important issues, and one of them are the organizing right to union, the right to organize a union of government employees. They don't have right now, so they are now organizing to struggle. But another issue is privatization, because of the neoliberalist policy of the government. The power plant, railways, and different kind of public companies are now being privatized by the government. So there are a lot of struggle against this.
On the issue of North Korea, President No responded,
North Korea has two alternatives. One is to go down a blind alley with a dead end, or it can take the path of openness and opportunity.
Samsung, Kissinger Associates, Hyundai, the Boeing Company, and many others were some of the companies hosting Mr. No during his visit. Currently, South Korea is facing a transport strike, which started last week, and is costing the economy about $190 million a day. As Asia's economy remains questionable and foreign investment becoming key, a visit by Prime Minister Koizumi of Japan and Philippine President Gloria Arroyo will follow No's visit in the coming weeks. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Simba Russo.
In Portland, Oregon, six American citizens stand accused of federal crimes allegedly associated with terrorist activities. Among the charges being brought against the five men and one woman are conspiracy to levy war against the United States, conspiracy to provide material support to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, money laundering, and other charges. One of the six accused individuals remains at large. Now 7 months after the original six were indicted, a seventh defendant has been added to the case. Maher Hawash, a software engineer formerly with Intel and also a naturalized citizen, is included in the superseding indictment. Lisa Hamid has more from Portland.
The lengthy detention of Maher Hawash, commonly known as Mike, has drawn national political and civil rights attention to the Pacific Northwest. Sitting in the gallery at the arraignment was criminal defense attorney Stanley Cohen. He was in Portland working on an unrelated case, but attended the arraignment and status hearing. He was asked about the federal government's increasing use of material witness orders to indefinitely detain people not charged with any crime.
You mean the fact that the government might use a material witness order as a pretext to strip someone of their liberty, their rights, their freedom, and all that stuff? I think it's an outrage. I think that it's been litigated. There's a decision in the Southern District right now in New York by an independent judge who found that it was unconstitutional, illegal. It's been argued in the Second Circuit. There's no opinion yet.
There are 15 counts listed in the indictment. Not all defendants are charged with each count. Named in the case, besides Hawash, are Jeffrey Battle, Patrice Lumumba Ford, Ahmed Bilal, Mohammed Bilal, and October Lewis, also known as Khadija. During the arraignment, Whitney Boyes, Ford's lawyer, voiced his concern over privacy issues. He wanted assurances of attorney-client confidentiality during jailhouse conversations. Such confidentiality can no longer be assumed since the passage of the Patriot Act. But the prosecutor, U.S. Attorney Gorder, quickly responded that none of the defendants' conversations with their respective attorneys would be electronically surveilled. Also, because of the high-profile publicity which the case has received in the region, there are concerns about the defendants' ability to receive a fair trial. With the exception of Mike Hawash, whose current lawyer was brought onto the case just recently, all the defendants have asked the court to try them separately rather than together. But Judge Robert Jones, in referring defense counsels to another case in which numerous defendants were successfully tried together, seemed to indicate that he has no interest in trying them separately. A hearing to examine and debate evidence is currently scheduled for Monday, June 9th, at which time arguments and other defense motions will be heard. The court date for the start of the trial is still on for Wednesday, October 1st. It will be a jury trial and is expected to span at least an 8-week period. From KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Lisa Hamid for Free Speech Radio News.
The Pacifica Foundation may be a step closer to adopting new bylaws which will enfranchise Pacifica listener supporters as members and will allow them to elect their local station's governing boards for the first time in history. Evan Davis has this report. For the purposes of full disclosure, Free Speech Radio News receives funding from the Pacifica Foundation.
The Pacifica Radio Foundation has been engaged in a long and arduous process of drafting a new set of bylaws ever since a court-supervised settlement created Pacifica's current interim national board in January of last year. That board was tasked with writing bylaws that will define a new governing structure in which the local boards of all five Pacifica stations will be directly elected by the Pacifica listeners and staff, thus democratizing the network and making each of its stations more accountable and responsive to the communities they serve. Originally, the bylaws were to have been ratified by now, and elections were to have taken place this June, but one critical detail has become a sticking point, and no agreement has been reached. This issue in question is a bold affirmative action plan for the network's governing boards. Pacifica National Board Secretary Carol Spooner.
What we're talking about now is affirmative action in the context of an election. Pacifica's local boards will be elected by the members, and there's a great deal of interest in our local boards being diverse, reflecting the community, the demographics of the community, and of our listeners. The issue for our bylaws is, should we or could we set aside specific seats by race or gender or ethnicity? So that affirmative action is legal in this country in the sense that aggressive outreach is legal for recruiting purposes. What is not legal and what is really the bone of contention is not affirmative action. What is the bone of contention is whether or not we can have quotas.
Although there is virtual unanimity among Pacifica activists that a strong affirmative action program is both needed and desirable, disputes remain over what form that policy should take. In March, Pacifica's National Board created a committee to draft a compromise affirmative action proposal. Ray LaForest of Pacifica Station WBAI in New York chairs that committee.
We're looking at difficult odds. We have to achieve the most efficient, powerful, the clearest notions that we can put in the bylaws that would facilitate, encourage participation by all those that are being excluded. The dilemma is, how do we do so without putting ourselves open ourselves unnecessarily to being sued from within or without, without wasting any funds or any more time that we have wasted so far? I think that the issue in general has been underestimated, and that the desire of people to have this take place as becoming more and more evident.
Diallo Katumbo, a local board member at Pacifica's KPFT in Houston, devised a plan by which local committees in each signal area will determine diversity goals based on local demographics and would issue recommendations to the local election supervisors. According to this plan, if diversity goals are not met in a given election, a limited number of representatives may be added to the local board from among the next highest vote-getters in a targeted racial, physical, or gender category. Diallo Katumbo.
These committees, shortly after the election, they'll be formed. They'll come together to take a look at diversity issues within each station area and try to come up with some recommended goals for each station area. And also work with the election committee and the outreach committee to try to increase participation in the election of people from underrepresented communities. You know, where people come from, who they are, the life that they've lived, the pain that they've suffered, has a direct bearing on how people perceive the world. And so the need for the inclusion of people from many different groups is absolutely necessary with Pacifica, especially since one of the main parts of his mission is to try to bring people together and create understanding amongst people of the world. You can't do that unless you have an organization that includes most of the people of the world.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Evan Davis.
You've been listening to FSRN. I'm Deepa Fernandez.